time was November 1932. The government of German Chancellor Franz von Papen had just fallen after losing a critical vote in the Reichstag, the German parliament. Von Papen had to try to form a new coalition government. Up to that point, he had resisted the idea of bringing into his coalition a party which had been considered a fringe party a few years earlier, but which had rapidly grown due to the effects of the Depression in the previous 4 years, and now had more seats in the Reichstag than any other single party. That was the NSDAP, the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, or National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Nazis. Von Papen saw that an easy way to form a new government was to allow the leader of that party, Adolf Hitler, to become Chancellor of Germany. Von Papen, of course, was not a Nazi, but he eventually came around to the idea of allowing Hitler to become Chancellor. And he persuaded President Paul von Hindenburg to do this, with von Papen as Vice Chancellor. The position of Chancellor was not a particularly powerful one under German law, so von Papen thought that he, with his associates, could handle Hitler and keep him under control. But von Papen could not handle him. Hitler quickly outsmarted and marginalized von Papen and soon had absolute power. The rest is ugly history. Von Papen had made a pact with the devil, Hitler being a human devil. In this split sermon, I would like to show how, when we make a conscious decision to allow into our lives what we know is sin, to compromise with sin, and to abandon the struggle against a particular sin, we're similarly making a pact with the devil. And pacts with the devil never have good results. We can title the split sermon simply, A Pact with the Devil. Let's go back thousands of years earlier to the Garden of Eden. The devil, taking over the body of a snake, asked Adam and Eve to make a pact with him by taking the forbidden fruit, doing something which they knew that God had told them not to do. They went ahead and made a pact with the devil. And the sad results are detailed in Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 through 24. Peace treaties are supposed to end wars. A peace treaty should be made only with two types of enemies. First, an enemy which is completely defeated and unable to continue the war. Think of Germany and Japan after the Second World War. Or, second, an enemy which we're fairly sure is making a good faith effort, a good faith agreement to stop the war and to cease being the enemy, even though that enemy is not totally defeated. Think of Britain after the Revolutionary War or Germany after the First World War. But if we make a peace treaty with an incorrigible enemy which is not acting in good faith, then we're just playing into the enemy's hands. And I will mention here something that Dr. Green also mentioned. A historical example might be the 1939 non-aggression pact between Hitler and Stalin, the infamous Molotov-Ribbentrop pact. Although this was not technically a peace treaty, because Germany and the Soviet Union were not at that time at war, it was a pact not to go to war. What were the results? At least according to Alexander Solzhenitsyn's analysis in one of his books, Stalin trusted Hitler, who was his fellow mass murderer anyway, not to go to war with him. Solzhenitsyn, in fact, claimed that Hitler was the only person Stalin ever trusted in his life. But Hitler had other ideas. Hitler was simply planning to use the non-aggression pact to buy time, to build up his army for a later massive invasion of the Soviet Union, which occurred in 1941, which led to the terrible siege of Leningrad, as Dr. Green mentioned in his first split sermon. And Stalin's trust of Hitler ended up nearly costing him his life as the Nazi armies approached Moscow and almost captured it. They never got quite to besiege it, but they got very close. The lesson is one must not make a pact with a determined enemy. Another more recent example was the 1973 Paris Peace Accords, which quote-unquote ended the war in Vietnam. We wanted out. Although it is a valid question as to whether we should ever have been in Vietnam at all. A better analysis back in the 1950s might have shown that the Ho Chi Minh movement had such a degree of popular support within Vietnam that it was really fruitless for us to try to help South Vietnam fight off the communists. Once we left, they would be back. And that our resources could be better spent strengthening the next tier of countries such as Thailand. But in any case, we saw the 1973 agreement as an easy way to get out. But the other side, of course, was not sincere. It simply used the treaty as an opportunity to get the Americans out and then to regroup. 2 years later, in 1975, the communists rapidly overran not only South Vietnam, but all the rest of the former French Indochina. And, of course, in Cambodia, the result was the horrible, murderous Khmer Rouge regime. Again, a peace treaty with a determined enemy does not lead to peace. And what does Satan mean in Hebrew? It means adversary. Our enemy's name says it all. Let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. First Peter 5:8. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. When Hillel, or Lucifer, was defeated in his attempt to attack God directly and take over his throne, which attempt is described in Isaiah chapter 14, verses 13 and 14, then Hillel, or Lucifer, now renamed Satan, turned his wrath upon humans. Satan wants to keep as many potential members of the God family as possible from realizing their potential. He wants to see as many humans as possible ultimately perish in the lake of fire. And the way for him to do this is to keep humans permanently hooked on sin, since God will not allow sin into his family, as described in verses such as Revelation chapter 21, verse 8, and chapter 22, verse 15. And Satan is a very determined enemy. Every biblical indication is that he is incorrigible. Well, let's turn to chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. Revelation 12, starting in verse 7. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, Satan. And the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. He is shown trying to attack heaven again, being defeated once more. Then he turns his intensified wrath again at humans on the earth. Verse 12. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you, the angels who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. At that point, Satan's rule on earth is about to be up. It's about to be ended. So his wrath intensifies. And this wrath is particularly directed at us, at God's people. In the future, verse 13. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for 3.5 years from the presence of the serpent. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. Going to verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. He's specifically identified as being at war with us. And he does not surrender voluntarily, but he has to be put in prison by force. Let's turn over a couple of pages to chapter 20. Revelation chapter 20. Revelation 20, starting in verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal on him, so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. In a future sermon, I plan to discuss why apparently he will have to be released, but that's subject for another day. But anyhow, what does he do when he is released from prison? Has he had a change of heart and ceased being the enemy of humans? No. If we go, what does he do? What's the first thing he's shown us doing? Verse 7 in the same chapter. Now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and the brimstone, where the feast and the false prophet, the correct translation should be, had been. And they, the devil and his angels, will be tormented day and night forever and ever. First thing he's shown is doing, deceiving humans again and organizing them into a violent rebellion against the government of God. Satan is most certainly shown over and over again to be a very determined enemy who does not give up his struggle to turn humans against God and ultimately keep them out of the God family. And that is the type of enemy with whom we absolutely do not want to make any sort of pact or treaty. How, in fact, do we make a treaty with the devil? If there's one point that I would like to be remembered from this split sermon, it is that whenever we make a conscious decision to allow a certain sin into our lives, something that we know is forbidden by the law of God, something we know is sin, and we cease to struggle to root it out, then we're making a pact with the devil. We cease resisting the devil on that particular point. Let's turn to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. James 4, one verse, verse 7. Therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. If we cease resisting the devil on a certain point, and as a result, he will not flee from us. We've stopped struggling against that particular sin. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 12, a few pages back. Hebrews chapter 12, Hebrews 12, verse 4. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. We stop struggling against a particular sin, and we agree to let that particular sin overcome us rather than our trying to overcome it. The relevant scriptures would be Revelation, the second and third chapters of Revelation, 2 Peter chapter 2 verses 19 and 20, and Romans 12 verse 21. If we do that, we've gone too far. If we make a conscious decision to continue letting ourselves commit a particular sin, then we have become a slave of that sin. Let's turn to John chapter 8. John chapter 8. John 8 verse 34. Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin." What about King Solomon? Apparently from the beginning of his reign, let's turn to 1 Kings 11, chapter 40, verse 42. 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 42. And the period that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. So he reigned 40 years. Now let's compare that verse with chapter 14, 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 21. Solomon's son. And Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king. So he was born before Solomon became king. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah, an Ammonitess. So Solomon had married a foreign woman, an Ammonite woman, even before he became king. He thought it was all right to marry foreign women, despite the fact that they were practicing paganism. In a sermon I gave here about a year and a half ago, I touched on the likely background of why Solomon may have felt this way. He married women also from the nations with whom Israelites were forbidden to intermarry, described in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 2. Apparently, Solomon thought that he could handle these pagan wives and not be influenced by them. Although, he would have had to admit that he was violating a command of God by marrying them in the first place. 1 Kings verse 11, chapter 11, verse 2 forbids that. He said he was marrying women from forbidden nations. Solomon was making a pact with the devil. The result, of course, was that he could not handle these pagan wives. He had gone too far, and he ended up becoming a slave to their sin of paganism, as described in 1 Kings chapter 11 also, up through verse 8. Also Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 26. How about another case? How about the time of Jeroboam, the successor to Solomon in the northern kingdom, in what became the northern kingdom? How about the story of the man of God and the old prophet? The man of God from Judah had had direct contact with God, just as Adam and Eve had. God had warned him not to eat or drink anything in the northern kingdom of Israel when he went there to warn Jeroboam and the people. Let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 13, actually, back a page. 1 Kings 13, verse 9. The man of God said to King Jeroboam, "For so it was commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, you shall not eat bread, nor drink water, nor return by the same way you came." So this man of God stayed true to God's command when King Jeroboam invited him to a meal. But what happened later? In verse 18, there came an old prophet who claimed to have been told by an angel from God, to have this man of God from Judah eat bread and drink water. Verse 18, he said to him, this prophet said to him, I too am a prophet as you are, and an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, bring him back with you to your house, that he may eat bread and drink water. He was lying to him. Remember that during the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem, during the time of Hezekiah, which unlike the later Babylonian siege, this one was relieved. The Assyrian Rabshakeh made a similar false claim about being instructed by God to do something. The Rabshakeh said that God had told him to take the city, and it was false. And we remember what happened to his army. In 2 Kings 19, verse 35, I think 185,000 troops, if I remember the number correctly, fell in a plague that relieved the siege. You know what happened to his army? Don't lie. Not supposed to lie, especially about claiming that God told you something. But we see this time, going back to the man of God and the old prophet, this time the man of God fell for the prophet's lie. He had been previously instructed directly by God, and he should have ignored anyone who asked him to do something contrary to that instruction, just as Adam and Eve should have ignored the snake. The man of God had just invited a sin into his life, and he had therefore made a pact with the devil. And we can see the sudden gruesome result. If we go, skip down to verse 23 here in 1 Kings 13. So it was, after he had eaten bread and after he had drunk, that he saddled the donkey for him, the prophet whom he had brought back. When he was gone, a lion met him on the road and killed him. And his corpse was thrown on the road, and the donkey stood by it. The lion also stood by the corpse. But note also, if we look in verses 20 through 22, verse 26, verses 31 and 32, everything the old prophet was recorded as having said was true, except for that one crucial lie in verse 18. The one crucial lie. Basically, everything Satan told Adam and Eve was true, except when he told them they would not surely die as a result of eating the fruit. Satan's assertions that after they ate the fruit, the eyes of Adam and Eve would be opened and they would know good and evil. Those assertions were true. Genesis chapter 3, verses 5 through 7. But these true statements, let's turn there, Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. Going here in verse 5, for God, Satan, the snake, Satan inhabiting the snake said, but of the fruit, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. If we go to verse 7, after they ate the fruit, then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. Those assertions were true, but the true statements concealed the critical lie in verse 4, the lie that said, you will not surely die. In total contrast to these accounts, we could consider the behavior of our Savior, Jesus Christ, as described in the temptation chapter in Matthew chapter 4. Satan tempted him as he had tempted no other human being. Satan knew that if he could bring Christ down, he would not even have to bother with any other human being. Getting Christ to sin would have eliminated any chance for any human to enter the God family. But we can see from Christ's responses to Satan's three questions that he refused to do anything which Satan asked him to do. He never made any sort of pact with the devil. Satan is the enemy, and anything he asks us to do is to our detriment, even if it seems innocuous, like turning stones into bread. Jesus was unfazed by Satan's quoting and misuse of Scripture in the second temptation, when the devil said, go down from the pinnacle, because God won't let you cast your foot against a stone. Christ was the ultimate example of complete resistance to Satan, as we're told, where we read in James 4, verse 7, resist the devil so he will flee from us. And he fled from Jesus Christ when he told him to. He was the example we should follow. We should always follow the example, the supreme example of Jesus Christ. So what happened to Franz von Papen, the man who had made a pact with the human devil? Von Papen continued to speak out against Hitler's power grab for about a year and a half, but his speeches were of no avail in stopping it. Hitler is often believed to have tried to murder von Papen on the infamous night of the Long Knives in 1934. Hermann Göring might in fact have protected von Papen that night. But sadly, when von Papen saw that his attempts to control Hitler were fruitless, he started collaborating with Hitler. Von Papen later became Hitler's ambassador to Austria before the 1938 Anschluss, and subsequently his ambassador to Turkey. After the war, von Papen ended up as one of the defendants in the Nuremberg war crimes trials. Von Papen was one of a small number of defendants who were found innocent. His collaboration with the Nazis was reprehensible, but he had not committed any actual war crimes or crimes against humanity. A German denazification court did later sentence von Papen to prison, where he served 2 years. He was then released when the same court later reversed its judgment and acquitted him. He then tried to re-enter politics in Germany, but he was tainted by his record of collaboration with the Nazis. Von Papen did some writing, but ended up dying in relative obscurity. In the final analysis, there was no profit from his pact with the human devil. So let us not be like von Papen, or like Adam, or Solomon, or like the man of God in the time of Jeroboam. Let us not make a pact with the devil by consciously accepting any sin into our life. But as we read in James chapter 4, verse 7, let us rather continue to resist the devil so that he will flee from us. And as we're told in 1 John chapter 2, verse 14, let us overcome the evil one. And as Revelation 2, verse 10 tells us, let us be faithful unto death so that we may receive the crown of life.